Welcome to Manifold. My guest today is Russell Clark. Russell is a hedge fund investor. He was recommended to me by an institutional investor who listens to this podcast and who reads Russell's writing. Russell, I think, had two fairly recent articles, one on the Japanese economy and one on the Chinese economy. And I thought I would bring him on and have a conversation about those topics. Russell, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on. And we were just chatting about your background. And I always like to do a little bit of that biographical narrative at the beginning of every interview. And I think you started by saying that you grew up in Australia, but you spent a year of high school and some college as well in Japan. So maybe we could start by you telling us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it always sounds, I think, wild to do that to people from Europe or the States. But back in the sort of 80s and 90s, Japan was like the first rich country you got to when you left Australia. And back then as well, Japan was by far the biggest trading partner for Australia. And my uncle lived in Japan. So for my family, the idea of sending kids to study at high school for a year seemed to make a lot of sense because you learned the language, a lot of useful skill. So I did that in 91, which is sort of really the very top of the bubble economy, and was probably the first time in my life I really felt quite poor. I went from Australia to Japan. Everything was like 3-4 times the price. It was very, it was such a different way of living to what you had in Australia. It was just mind blowing. And in the end, I end up doing the Asian Studies and Economics degree at university. It specialized in Japanese. So I went back and did another year at university exchange in 94. Both of those times were in the sort of Kansai, Osaka, Kobe region. And then I think around sort of that period, you realize the Japanese economy was in deep, deep trouble. So I tried to take my Japanese language skills and convert them into Chinese language skills, which I didn't really get that far in. But I did spend a year in Hong Kong in 98 and sort of learned that.
Before we leave Japan, can I ask you a few questions about Japan in the 90s? Because I also spent some time there. I'm older than you, but as a young physics researcher and professor, I spent some time in Tokyo. And it's very timely because I don't know if you're watching the show Tokyo Vice. Ever heard of this show?
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
So it's on HBO, and this season one already happened. It was quite popular, and they brought it back, and now they're sort of in the middle of season two. And there were actually books. I don't know if you read these books. The person that the main character is based on is a guy called Jake Adelstein, who was an American guy who became a crime reporter in Tokyo. And this is at a time when the Yakuza were still a big thing. And so the show it's actually produced by the same guy who produced the show Miami Vice back in the 80s. I guess that was an 80s show. And this is called Tokyo Vice. So anyway, it's set in the exact era when you were in Tokyo. So you might enjoy it. Totally different from today, where now Tokyo is kind of like a pretty good value for money vacation destination. At the time, it was staggeringly expensive for foreigners. And maybe you could just tell me, let me ask you a pointed question. So for old Tokyo hands from my era, have you ever heard of a club called Juliana Tokyo?
I have heard of Juliana Tokyo. Although I was living in the Osaka, Kobe region.
Oh, Osaka. Okay.
Yeah. So which is a very wild nightlife and even more Yakuza than Tokyo, I think.
Yeah.
It's like that's the stronghold for that, if that makes sense.
So any good, what's your favorite story from that era living in Japan?
there's quite a lot because I sort of skipped out when I was talking to you before, but so Australians can get working holiday visas as well. And I took a year off university and spent 6 months working as a bartender in Osaka to pay for being a backpacker around Europe. And we used to see all sorts of strange things because this bar was open very late. I think the thing that was most crazy about this bar is it was open till 5 a.m. And then there would be bars that would open at 5 a.m. for the people who stopped at these bars that worked really late. And that's, and they'd be full of people like me, Australians and Brazilians and stuff. And it was a very strange lifestyle because most of the bartenders, foreign bartenders and other stuff, other people didn't have proper work visas. So they would disappear for Korea for a day or two and maybe they would come back or maybe they wouldn't, but they'd just be there and then disappear. I think the thing that I find most interesting about that time was, you know, when it's just sort of early mid 90s is that you could teach English on the side and make around 2000 yen an hour, which for unqualified work, you know, you didn't need any qualifications, was fantastic money at the time.
That's incredible.
However, if you go, it was great at the time. It was about, you know, I would say like, you know, maybe three to four times what you could earn for still similar jobs in Australia. So you could really save a lot of money very quickly. The weird thing is that that wage for teaching English in Japan has not changed from really the early 90s, which wow. is, gives you, so Japan hasn't really, it's sort of gotten cheap because the exchange rate's fallen, but it's also gotten cheap because prices just haven't moved. And it's just, it is quite amazing how that's happened. I think what you find with Japan now is that, and still talking to friends who live there, like anything that's very international, so the international hotel chains, they charge the sort of international price. But if you've got the ability and the bravery to access like Japanese-focused hotels, you can pay really extraordinary low rates for really, really high quality. So it's like almost a bifurcated economy in Japan, like an international economy, when the domestic economy that's still very weak, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think for people in the 90s, they never could have guessed this would be the situation because it would, you know, things were so expensive then. And I guess you were there when the sort of the bubble had burst and you could see the Japanese economy was going to be in a kind of dismal state for a while. But in the 80s, the Americans actually were worried that Japan would displace them. That's the number one economy in the world and actually took active steps to prevent that from happening.
Yeah. Well, it's being repeated now with China. So, you know, and there's a classic sort of, for me, it's always American sort of capitalism is about, hey, make as much money as you can, but also making sure no one comes and eats your lunch and yep. using you know, whatever means are possible. And, yeah, that was Japan back in the 80s. And then when Japan started to weaken in the 90s, that fell off. And now China's been strong. And now, you know, U.S. is using various measures to try and keep China down. Whether it'll be effective or not, I don't know. It's too early yeah. to tell.
But we can get into that. That's the main sort of focus of our conversation. But I want to get through a little bit of your interesting bio before we turn to that. So now a little bit later, late 90s, you are actually living and working in Hong Kong. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I ended up in. My brother was living in Hong Kong. And I had taken another year off during my degree. It took me a long time to finish my university degree. I ended up in Hong Kong needing a job, and I had good Japanese skills. So I worked for this company, taking sort of Japanese clients up into factories in southern China. It was a really interesting job. I enjoyed it a lot. But you could see like the amazing infrastructure the Chinese were putting in. You could see how competitive prices were. And yet for me, it was a real eye-opener in where I think China was going to go, you know. And so I sort of, for me, that was like, okay, I need to become like a China expert and be very bullish on China. Where it really wasn't, back in the early 2000s, because of the Asian financial crisis and other stuff, people were very negative on Asia as a whole. And think about, and so it was very difficult to find jobs actually that got you into China in the early 2000s. It was very, very difficult indeed.
And things were very rough then. I mean, much compared to if you go to a tier one Chinese city now, things are so developed, the beautiful metro system and the airport, and things are pretty clean. And but early 2000s or even the 90s, it was so incredibly rough, right? Like early Shenzhen was like nothing, and they had, you know, I remember going there and they didn't have sidewalks. They would put up a skyscraper and then there would be like dirt sidewalks around the thing and muddy roads and stuff like just insane.
Yeah. Well, my brother was a lawyer, so we used to go long way south to try and like intellectual property lawyer. So we'd be going to like weird markets trying to find counterfeit goods. I remember one day, so we can get a ferry, like a hydrofoil, back to Hong Kong. So we got on this hydrofoil, this old Russian one from the 80s. Everything was written Russian. And they, and it was like a 4-hour ride. They said, oh, we'll put a movie on. And it was a pirated movie. Halfway through, the camera had fallen on its side and they still kept pirating it. So you just had to sit there like this, watching it. And it was just crazy. And yeah, I mean, I was only like 24 at the time. So I loved the wildness of it. You get a bus to go somewhere. And it was such a wild capitalist place. It's like the bus driver would sell you to another bus driver because they were trying to get their buses full. So if they didn't have a full bus, they go, okay, you're now getting on this other bus, that was just the way it was. Everything was free and crazy. And now it's much more developed. I'd love to go back. I haven't been to China for a long time now. The high-speed rail just looks amazing, among other things.
I had a guy on the show named Louis Gavet, who runs this Gavical Research out of Hong Kong. And he made this joke, which I thought was just spot on, and love to hear your reaction about it. He said, actually, the Japanese would be the most natural communists because they're very collectivist and top-down. And the Chinese actually should be the ones that have the crazy free market system because they're much more entrepreneurial and individualistic. I'm curious whether that resonates with your experiences.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky one. I used to think that myself. But then when I look at modern Japanese policy, it just seems to be about impoverishing the worker for the benefit of Warren Buffett for no apparent reason. The Japanese economy is so strange. I mean, they could solve most of their problems if they just gave everyone a pay rise. Mm-hmm. And yet they resolutely refuse to even think that, government-driven pay increases would be acceptable, which puts it more in a sort of capitalist type situation, I think. It is interesting. So my thoughts on that are very varied at the moment. Looking at how the world works. I think we perceive as Japanese as being socialist because they definitely have a sort of social construct like that. But then they're very capitalistic in the way they look at profits and the distribution of that. So it's interesting.
So from those early days in Hong Kong, how did you get into the, I guess, buy side financial industry, and what are the main markets that you have experienced trading in?
Yeah, so when I lived in Hong Kong, that was when it's probably lost to the market memory for most people, but it was the tail end of the Asian financial crisis, and a bunch of hedge funds tried to break the Hong Kong dollar peg, and they had a dual strategy. It looks like you remember this. Yeah. So they were shorting the Hong Kong dollar, but they were also shorting the Hang Seng Index, which was mainly made up of property developers. And the logic of it was, and I thought this was fantastic, was that they have to raise interest rates to defend the peg, but that's going to crush the stock market because it's mainly leveraged property developers. The early guys made tons of money, but then the Hong Kong Monetary Authority came in and burned them badly. But I was so fascinated by the economics and how that was working. I thought, this is what I want to do with my life. So I went back to Australia, finally finished my degree, got a graduate trainee job with UBS, worked for Sydney in 2 years as a graduate trainee. And because I went well, they allowed me to try and apply for jobs overseas. Like I said, in 2002, or 2001, I was looking for jobs in Asia. Hong Kong would have been ideal, no hiring at all. So the closest I could find was an emerging market analyst for a hedge fund in London. So I joined that. And my thinking was at the time, believe it or not, China was a very small part of the emerging market investable universe. You had Malaysia, Taiwan were all big markets. And I was thinking, well, if I'm right in where I think China is going here, then China will become the sort of emerging market index. And that was probably correct. And so I ran that. So I started off as an analyst, and then 4 years later got headhunted to set up a hedge fund, which I did. And, you know, around 2011 or so, you could see that the Chinese story was falling apart. And it was going for me the same way as like the Asian economies of like Korea and Taiwan and Thailand. So, you know, I started to aggressively short China-related names. And that was really sort of what made my name. Because I think people were very bullish on China 2011, 12. And then, you know, someone coming out and saying it's all falling apart, I think really sort of set me on a different path. But I think the world's changing again. I think it is. I think what China's doing is very interesting. I don't think it's as bad as people make out. I think, you know, when I look at it, I think the US reminds me more of Japan in 91 now, if that makes sense. Like it's, the economy's been pumped up so much and price levels in the States are so out of whack with what you see in places like Europe. And it's the same sort of belief. I mean, the weird thing about the States is typically when you have such a booming economy, the government is not running a fiscal deficit of 5-6% of GDP.
Yes.
That's not usual. Something's going on there.
You're also not usually a late stage declining empire. we'll get into all this stuff, I guess. But that's a great place to segue. And I think for the listeners now, I think we've established your bona fides in a sense, because you lived in Japan, you've lived in Hong Kong, close observer of both economies, Chinese and Japanese economies, and actually made some successful long-term macro trades, it sounds like, in the 2000s and 2010s. So I think often when I, this is just my perspective, I'm not attributing it to you, but when I talk to younger people in finance who didn't live through all that, they tend to have, I would say, often miscalibrated views, especially about China. And right now, I think there's a kind of crescendo of propaganda. Like if you read the Wall Street Journal or FT or New York Times, just, there's this crescendo of propaganda about how the Chinese economy is collapsing, but I don't really see signs of that so much. So maybe we can discuss that. It seems like you have a slightly contrarian view now about China relative to everybody else. Maybe you can just express that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, when you look at, if I look at how the world used to work, let's say up until 2016 in a sort of free market capitalist world, was whenever a major nation got into credit problems, so like the States or Europe, Japan, Asia back in the 90s, or the Latin American nations in the sort of 80s and 2000s, the very typical choice then from governments was to devalue. And the logic of it is that by devaluing, A, you make that credit problem easier to deal with, and B, you're sending half your problems to your trade partners.
Yep.
That makes sense.
Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, and it was, that is just was standard policy. Now, the problem with it was that anyone that had dollar debt or foreign debt would then suffer dramatic consequences for a while.
Yep.
But then the sort of in a sort of classic, Trumpitarian sort of view is you clear out all the dead capital to allow, you know, just, you know, allow new businesses to thrive. And that would be pretty much the way I think, policy has run since the 1980s. So what was weird is in 2016, China got into trouble. You know, it was definitely, there was a panic. There was devaluation fears. And then suddenly China said, you know what? We're not going to devalue. We're just going to close our capital account. We've got control of the banks and we're going to keep our exchange rate relatively strong. Mm-hmm. I know people talk about being weaker than it was, but if you compare it to some of the other exchange rates you see, like especially what the yen has done, yen's being weak and the market loves it. And there's no, you know, it's just a perception thing. The Chinese yuan's been very strong. I guess, and then a few years later, probably my last big trade before I decided to shut down the fund I was running, because I suddenly realized that the world was working in a different way, was, you know, in 2021, you know, I was reading the newspaper and it was talking about how the Chinese regulators had decided to have a chat with Alibaba and Tencent and IQI and who else? Weibo, all big internet guys. I was like, oh, this is interesting. And basically what the regulator was saying, the thing about it is it's very hard for me to get super negative on the Chinese because a lot of their policies make a lot of sense. So they basically said to these tech guys, do you know what? We have no problem with you collecting data, but you can only use the data for the businesses it was collected from.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So if you collect a business on a real estate website, you can only use it for that real estate website. If you suddenly sell it to another person or use it in another arm of your business, that's not going to, that's no good. And I was reading this and the market at the time loved Chinese tech. I was thinking, this sounds really bad. You know, they're really sort of going for the tech business model, which is sort of like vertical expansion, mm-hmm. using your existing position to dominate. So I showed them, I made a lot of money, but my only problem was that I thought, well, if Chinese tech goes, US tech will follow. And actually what happened was the US tech did this, Chinese tech did this.
Yep.
And I suddenly realized, you know, it's not the same market where all assets move in the same way. You got China is doing its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't understand why I wanted to do that. I couldn't understand why it didn't devalue its exchange rate. I couldn't understand why it was destroying its champions. And all of it was sort of political. I really needed some time out to have a think about why the Chinese were so different to elsewhere, if that makes sense. And I think the Japan-China comparison now is actually very germane in that, you know, the Japanese have decided they were tired of deflation. So they devalued like crazy. The yen is super weak. Everyone knows it's cheap. But I don't see any particularly strong benefit to Japanese workers. In dollar terms, they're back to where they were in 1990.
Yep.
And I think, yeah. And well, the more I look at it, just to me, China is actually sort of more socialist in that he wants to keep real wages strong and it doesn't really care what profits do.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Yep.
Whereas the Japanese model in that city is more about, we don't care what happens to wages. We just want to keep profits strong. I think that's a big difference. And I think the between those two countries at the moment. And actually, if you look at like hard indicators of activity, Chinese activity is not that poor.
Yeah.
It's just the stock market's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just to drill down on that a little bit, because I think our listeners would be interested in this. Of course, this Chinese stock market has been very poorly performing in the last few years. But if you look at their trade surplus, which is kind of approaching, I always think in terms of round numbers, but it's kind of approaching $1 trillion a year in trade surplus. And you look at specific industries like autos or solar, you know, very big industries that I think are going to be of global impact. Their companies seem to be extremely strong, actually. So, I think there's a little bit of a disconnect between the way the financial markets are performing and the actual, in a sense, core strength of their economy. Now, it is true that they have had a property bubble, which the government has been well aware of, and now maybe have finally taken steps, right, to pop this thing. And of course, that's going to cause some period of malaise in the economy. But it, in terms of the underlying fundamentals, I don't see it as being as weak as what, you know, US media would report. Maybe you can react to what I just said.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I mean, I think the thing about China as a sort of a one party dictatorship, they can't really let economic problems get out of hand because then if they burst,
yeah,
it becomes a political problem very rapidly. So, you know, they have, I think, gone out and tried to actively, you know, get rid of the property bubble that was definitely existing in China. And trying to make life easier for workers. I think that's where that policy is aimed at. in like the UK. I'm not sure where US property prices are now, if they're crazy expensive or not. It's hard to tell.
They're pretty high.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Well, London, they're also, London, UK, they're quite high, and it's become a huge political issue. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you look at like conservatives in the UK, they're going to get destroyed. They probably have a generational loss at the next election and lose, you know, a vast number of members. So if the Chinese Communist Party, which has control over all levers of the economy, says, well, we can't have that type of political loss, they act, I think, earlier. And I think what with my view is we've sort of seen a slowly seen the rest of the world follow. I mean, interesting in the UK, what I find really fascinating is like with Labour looking like they're going to win the election, suddenly the Bank of England's talking about selling its entire bond portfolio and exiting QE entirely. Because I think partly, I think QE is a sort of pro-capital policy in that this idea that ever-rising asset prices can lead to great economic outcomes.
Yep.
It does lead to good economic outcomes, but it also leads to bad political outcomes.
Yep.
Those have been, from a sort of, if you're a conservative voter, that's been realized and that the conservatives now are unelectable in the UK. And if I look at the US, the new Republican Party looks like nothing like the old Republican Party, which was a very different beast.
Right.
And so you can see these machinations happening. And China has got the same issues, but they've dealt with them in a different way, I think.
This is the first I've heard of the Bank of England selling its bond portfolio. I mean, you know, in the case of the US, the action of last resort is just to add stuff to the Fed balance sheet, and nobody's really looking at that apparently. So you can just put whatever on there you want and solve whatever economic problems you have by just having the Fed take it over. But what would happen, like if you mark that portfolio to market, where would it leave the Bank of England? Is now a good time for them to sell their bond portfolio?
Well, I think that's part of the issue is that when they first built out the portfolio, they made good money.
Yeah.
And those profits were repatriated back to the Chancery. And then in recent times, they've been losing money.
Yeah.
And so they're going, I think they're saying, okay, let's just dump this portfolio so we don't have to ask for money from the government to sort of hold, to make the portfolio whole. So I think also if you look at Labour policies, they're very big into like building a lot of houses. They're probably going to be increasing public spending, raising taxes. So an inflationary policy mix. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're trying to prepare the policy space to react to that. So if they know they're going to take a huge loss on a lot of their bonds because they're going to be jacking rates up, it does make sense to try and sell that preemptively.
Somehow the market doesn't, the Bank of England knows this is how it's going to play out and the market doesn't know this is how it's going to play out.
You see it surprisingly often in, I think, what I found really interesting, my personal view is that we have now entered a sort of cycle where we need to sort of reduce income inequality. And the easiest way to do that is to push up wages rather than collapse asset markets because we don't like that.
Yep.
And so wages are going up. And so interest rates need to go up much more. I'm sort of thinking 10% would be the right level at the end of the cycle. And everyone has that face on. And I go, well, you know, interest rates have been 10% not that long ago, certainly in my lifetime. And what I think it is when I talk to people is that asset owners can't accept the idea that policies could be negative, would negatively affect them. It's just so beyond their comprehension. Whereas if you go back to the 80s when we were like, defanging unions, allowing factories to move to, China or wherever. If you looked at what voters and the power of unions in the 70s and then look what happened in the 80s or 90s, that would have been mind-blowing to them. What, the government's going to allow, cut tariffs and allow factories to move to Mexico and elsewhere? That's exactly what happened because that's where the votes were.
Yeah.
And I think that's a similar type of thing. I think people just are like, you're trying to, I can't, that can't be right because then I would lose money. That can't be right. You're like, do you have the votes? That's the question.
Yeah, it's good. The U.S. system, it's can you, if you're going to harm capital, if you're going to harm the 1%, can you get elected? And under certain circumstances, yeah, maybe you can. But it's kind of a, I think in the recent era, the sort of uniparty, the sort of centrist Democrats and Republicans really have been very, pro-capital. And so, you know, it would be a kind of change into a different kind of political regime for that to happen. But maybe it has to happen.
Well, the states, you know, American corporates are very well run and very intelligent people. So a lot of the rule changes in recent years have made U.S. elections so expensive.
Yeah.
And exactly. It's almost impossible to get enough political power without having corporate sponsors.
Yep.
Some sort or another. You know, what's interesting is the sort of populist politicians that come from the right. It sort of makes sense in that a lot of their policies aren't, the old economic policies aren't popular, so you need different type. The issue is whether you get a sort of left-wing reaction to that at some point, whether you get like the sort of Democratic Reagan. I don't know who that is. You know, but yeah, but it may take time. I find that a very interesting way of thinking about it because, you know, the implication, it sort of adds lots of different investment implications to the history and sometimes makes for very counterintuitive investment cases. But yeah, I find it very interesting.
Coming back to the property bubble in China, which the government now is taking steps to, you know, pop that bubble. And I mean, of course, prices have come down quite a bit. So in a sense, they clearly are in the process of popping it. And they're now going to suffer the knock-on effects, you know, in terms of employment and people being much less secure in you know, maybe their major investment thing is they own some apartments or something in some city in China. So that they're dealing with those consequences. The question is, you know, is it something that I do have a view on whether this could actually turn into a crisis in China or whether it's something that they'll be able to manage?
I think economically, I don't see it being a big problem to manage. And they've still got a lot of levers. I mean, one of the things about China, which I think people forget, is they still have like that big division in their internal market, like the Hukou. Mm-hmm. So not everyone can move to Shanghai, right? It's not free like that. And they've already made a lot of some adjustments, but there's still huge internal adjustments that they could do.
Yeah.
The other thing I always think about is that if you're looking to sort of reduce income inequality a bit, what that really does imply is that cities will tend to underperform relative to rural areas, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And that would be a policy. And you can sort of see, even in the States, you sort of see that sort of town versus country type political divide, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like New York and San Francisco and LA are seen as bad places, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, Ohio or, you know, Illinois, you know, these sort of more rural areas are seen as better. You know, there's that type of dynamic at play. And, you know, and this is all, the thing about China, I always, you know, it's sort of staggering for me. It's like with such a large population, no one can really know exactly what's going on. You know, yeah, okay, maybe unemployment's high in Shanghai. And yeah, it's like a 25, 30 million people city, you know, is big, but actually in the big scheme of things in China, it's not actually that big.
Yeah, that city alone is bigger than Taiwan and, you know, similar to like a lot of medium-sized European countries, but
well,
you're
it's
right.
As
a fraction of all of China, it's quite small.
Exactly. And so it's a, you know, I normally say to people that what I find very weird about Asia and China in particular is that the further people are away from it, the more confidence they have in their opinion
exactly.
of what's exactly happening. Whereas, I mean, what I find a lot is how a lot of sort of old expats from Hong Kong tell me, heck, Hong Kong's dying. And I go, what do you mean? And I say, oh, Lung Kwai Fong is not as busy as it used to be. I mean, well, Lung Kwai Fong, if you know Lung Kwai Fong,
yeah,
it's for a very small part of the Hong Kong population.
Yeah.
The vast majority of Hong Kong Chinese live out in the new territories in these very different types of places to Lan Kwai Fong and Disco Bay.
Yeah.
And essentially, you know, Hong Kong's just becoming a Chinese city as it should be.
Yeah.
I would be, what's quite extraordinary, I think. I think what the Chinese Communist Party probably could rightly point out is that, you know, Hong Kong was, you know, originally a British city, or, you know, was originally a Chinese city, but the British really made it. Just across the border in Shenzhen, it's a Chinese-made city, and Shenzhen has developed far more new innovative companies mm-hmm. than Hong Kong has. Hong Kong's just owned by five families who basically all run oligopolies and haven't actually invented a new business for a long time. While Shenzhen, you've got loads of different companies.
Yeah, I mean, as a Chinese American, I had a girlfriend who was from one of these wealthy families in Hong Kong, actually one of the famous ones. And my wife and I, who are both academics, were actually at one point considering moving to Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, which, you know, they have that campus out overlooking
the Kowloon.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty familiar with the dynamic there, and it's exactly what you said. There's not that much dynamism in Hong Kong. It's a bunch of people who own property and old companies, and all the dynamism is not just Shenzhen, but that whole Pearl River Delta area, which is being developed in a very formidable way. Like, that whole thing, once it's fully developed, will be one of the big economic drivers of the whole global economy, actually, because it will include Shenzhen and Hong Kong, but also, you know, Guangdong and other areas. The academics that I know, so Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, it's a little bit like an MIT type school. They're all looking forward to getting integrated into the Pearl River Delta economy, because they want their graduates to be able to go into Shenzhen and start companies and build companies and do all this stuff. And so that's really the picture. I think all this old style thinking in terms of like property or even finance as the driver in Hong Kong, I think that's kind of going to get dominated by all this other stuff that's in the region.
I think that's where they're going with their policy. I think they're actively trying to discourage, building your own cartel, which has sort of become the US business model, is sort of, you know, capture the market and then raise prices. And they're trying to discourage that, to sort of encourage more investment into hard tech. I think for anyone, you and me included, is ever since it's become like a trade war or a cold war, getting data from China is really, really hard.
Yes.
And a lot of the data that you see or news articles you see in the West, obviously, you know, for me, not tilted, you know, gone from being excessively optimistic to now excessively pessimistic. And, you know, I always find it extraordinary. I was reading The Economist one week, this was a few months ago.
Right.
And the Ukrainians had fired their general, and they're saying this is because corruption is being rooted out. This is really positive. And I thought, okay, I guess so. And then in the same article, China had just fired a general for corruption. And the conclusion was, this shows how bad China is. And obviously failing. And I went, they literally did exactly the same thing. And I just say, you know, it's like, you know, I think, you know, I sort of see that, you know, corruption was obviously the problem in China. And, you know, they've tried to deal with it. Obviously, there's a political aspect to that. Gut feeling, and I talk about this recently, is I think the real problem between China and the U.S. is the same problem the U.S. had with Japan, is that U.S. wants to be number one. And that does imply, with a country as big as China, mm-hmm. that you have to keep it relatively poor on a GDP per capita basis.
Yes.
Otherwise, the U.S., China becomes bigger. And I think that's the real problem. Because that is actually, I think, really at the heart of it is the problem of it.
You know, in the 80s, Japan, with, you know, roughly half the population of the U.S., maybe even less than that, through a scare, into Americans. I mean, I was growing up at that time, so I remember there were books like Japan is Number One by Ezra Vogel, the Harvard professor. And there were movies like Black Rain with Michael Douglas. I don't know if you remember this movie, but they were really Americans. Yeah, Americans were really worried about Japan in the '80s. People, younger people now don't know about any of this. But now, in the case of China, you have a country which is little more than 10 times larger in terms of population, greater natural resources, isn't still occupied by American bases, you know? So it's a totally different situation. And it's exactly what you say. If they just even have like kind of a normal pace of development, eventually it's going to threaten the U.S. status as global number one. So I think there's no avoiding the U.S. really taking a very aggressive stance vis-a-vis. This is what people often call the Thucydides trap, right? That number one is always going to react in a very aggressive manner to suppress number two. And then the dynamic is that just, it's very tough to avoid like an out of control escalation that leads even to war or something like that. But that dynamic is really hard to avoid.
Well, what I find really interesting is so when Russia invaded Ukraine, you know, the US put a lot of sanctions on it. But most of the large emerging markets are just ignoring those sanctions, including India, which India is supposed to be a big new ally for the US. Yeah. And the way I think about it is, Indians are very clever people, long-term thinking as well. I think they look at the China-US problem and go, well, that could be us in 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, so I think that's why they have a very mixed reaction to it. They're not fully supportive of what the US is trying to do there.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, it's sort of, you know, very logical and natural. Real problem, the issue I think is US can do what it wants to as long as it retains its reserve currency status. And if it doesn't, that's when it all falls apart, you know. And that is I think that for me is a real key question. Do people keep buying treasuries? Why would you buy these IOUs from a state that doesn't seem to be able to balance its budget, even during a massive booming economy?
Yeah, I myself can't get my head around this. I would probably make a terrible macro trader because I just don't understand how other people think about these things. But yeah, I mean, it seems to me it's not a good move to accumulate treasuries. But something, there's still so much inertia in the system, right? I guess there are plenty of people who would step up and defend the dollar hegemony lasting for many more decades. And they would just say, like, well, what's the competitor? Like, why would you know, do you really trust the Chinese government? Do you want to hold yuan? You know, I guess that's the kind of our counter argument they would give.
I think it all ultimately is sort of political. For me at the moment, the reason why I think a lot of people, I mean, in finance, it's very typical in finance. Unfortunately, it's not like theoretical physics where you get good research and people make reasonable arguments. I think most arguments in finance are typically based on what's happened over the last 2-3 years and they say and extrapolate forever. I think my current thinking is ties back into Japan is that Japan is the biggest holder of treasuries outside of, any other country. And Japan is also the big lender to the US economy, through many of its institutions. And so what I think Japanese policy has done is a weak yen has put a lot of pressure on Asian nation currencies. Mm-hmm. So it's created that downward pressure on the yuan. You go to countries like Mexican peso, which is historically very weak, are being very strong because they're being helped by U.S. policy. Japanese policy of very low interest rates and devaluing the yen has created natural support for the dollar. And they only buy treasuries. Bank of Japan only buys treasuries. It doesn't buy any gold.
Yeah.
Historically, it's never bought gold. Only buys treasuries.
Can you comment on that? So why is it just like a kind of cultural hangover that this is the way the Bank of Japan has always done things, so they're just going to keep doing it? Is it the fact that, you know, if you talk to a leftist, quasi-Marxist Japanese professor, even the physicist, they'll say, yeah, we're still a U.S. colony. Like, we don't have that much autonomy. So and that's why the, you know, Bank of Japan is always buying treasuries. But I'm curious what your interpretation is of this.
Yeah, I think there's two things. One, of course, Japan was bankrupt after World War II, so it had no gold or any pre-existing gold at that period. Does have the U.S. bases and is a very close U.S. ally. But I also think, you know, Japanese are excellent investors. They tend to think very long term. And so Japan is a big importer of natural resources, right? So if they have these spare dollars accumulating from trade surpluses, why would they buy gold, which actually promotes higher commodity prices, which is the actual opposite of what they're trying to achieve? By treasuries, they keep the yen weak and they promote growth in their major trade partner. And that makes a lot of sense to me. Gotta remember though, you know, sort of big non-gold foreign reserves is actually a very, very recent economic phenomenon. Yeah, and Japan basically invented it. Japan invented building foreign reserves and treasuries, and they invented QE. You know, so they've been at the sort of forefront of this very new, strange economic model that we have. And yeah, it's that for me is the logic of it. And also trying to, I think, a quid pro quo for having all the bases in Japan was, you know, basically funding the U.S. government. But I think the problem you got is, you know, the Japanese are very rational people. If they can see that, you know, China is not going to go away and the U.S. is struggling to fund itself, I could see them doing a deal with the Chinese at some point.
Yeah. The big geopolitical deal that I think most East Asians think about is, you know, what point will China basically neutralize South Korea and Japan vis-a-vis the U.S. rivalry? And can they do it? And, you know, maybe 10 years from now or 20 years from now, but that's like a big, big swing that may or may not happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I read a very fantastic book called Beyond Tamerlane, which is talking about empires.
Yep.
And it was interesting. It's like, you know, sort of Asian empires have tended to absorb economically rather than go out and conquer. You know, so you trade, merchants move there, and then, you know, it's been a sort of different way. I think that's the sort of Chinese modus operandi is just keep trading, you know, developing influence rather than go out in the rain.
I mean,
yeah, that's what they get I think that is it. I mean, the other thing as well is like, you know, I do need to get to China, but you can just see that the China reminds me in some ways of like its technology is sort of moved ahead of the West in so far as that they've adopted the facial recognition technology. So you just walk into a store and they automatically take your account. You know, which I'm sure Visa and MasterCard would push against massively. In the States. I just find a really, you know, an interesting time from that perspective. I worry about how it ends a little bit, but, you know, hopefully cooler heads will prevail.
On this dollar reserve currency question, do you have a view on when you think that will start to weaken? We're already starting to see, maybe we will see, you know, oil increasingly traded in other currencies other than the dollar.
Well, I think the U.S. is digging its own grave here in that. So if you go back to the sanctions that put on Russian energy exports, right? The idea is no one would buy Russian energy, right? It would collapse. And what's happened in practice is a whole bunch of nations have said, no, we'll buy it. But a discount fine, we'll buy it. And so I'm assuming that they pretty much avoid using any U.S. financial institutions and use the U.S. dollar because in the previous sanctions, people have used U.S. banks or U.S. dollars have been then sanctioned by the U.S. government.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
So I'm pretty sure there must be a financial infrastructure that's been built to facilitate the payment of Russian energy imports. And we know that Brazil, South Africa, India, China are all going to be big players in that because they are big buyers of Russian energy. So the funny thing is you don't have to go back that long. Even 10 years ago, Russia was already trying to get people to pay for their oil in renminbi or Chinese yuan or gold. Mm-hmm. And no one was doing it because it's such a chore, extra cost, there's no liquidity. And then basically US government has helped Russia in a way that they could never do on their own, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And, I think some of the tariffs on Chinese exports has then meant it's being redirected through, Southeast Asian nations as well. And again, there's going to be an infrastructure there to make it U.S. sanctions safe. So in many ways, I think the U.S. is digging its own grave because it's reducing, if you think about it from a tech echo flywheel perspective, the more people use Facebook, the more likely you have to use Facebook, right? Now, US dollar is the same sort of thing, except it's that, now you can't use US dollars for this transaction, and you can't use US dollars for this transaction. And they go, well, what do you want us to do? Not trade at all. And then so you create this new ecosystem, and it's at some point we'll reach this sort of quantum where somewhere like Japan or Korea, staunch US allies will be like, well, we're going to have to participate in this financial ecosystem as well, because we're starting to lose market share to people who don't use it, if you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I found really interesting as well, I sort of wrote in a recent note, is you can sort of see it beginning to happen. So in Vietnam is the new trade power in Asia. So South Korea's huge investment. There's trade surplus with the US is bigger than Japan now, right? But the Vietnamese are not accumulating US treasuries. They're falling. So I think we've already sort of crossed the Rubicon a little bit. It's just, having been around for a long time, interesting. This is, I don't know if you find this interesting or not, but I find it interesting. It's after the GFC, everyone was like, inflation's coming, super bearish bonds, super bearish treasuries, super bearish JGBs again. And I was like, guys, I think, if you look at the policies of austerity, no wage increases and probably China blowing up, you need to be buying bonds. It's deflation for as far as the eye can see. And people are like, well, you're crazy. And I said, that's just where the policy mix is. I made a lot of money from buying bonds, various different bonds over the years, loads of money. And then, it's true, just loads. And then you look at the world now and I'm like, well, wages are going to go higher to rebalance the economy. We've seen tariffs go up. Taxes have to go up. Everything is inflationary. Everything's inflationary. And yet people sort of go, 4% on a 30-year treasury. Give me some of that. I want to lock in 40% for 30 years.
And
it's weird how mentalities change that way.
Post-GFC, I had the same view as you. So people thought all this stimulus is going to be inflationary. But I thought, it's stimulus, but it's on the back of a huge catastrophe in the economy. So it's like, yes, we have this huge problem and then there's some stimulus. I don't see a lot of inflation. So I agreed with you. I agree with you. I had the same view as you right after the GFC. This view you have that a lot of what the governments have to do now is it sort of has to be inflationary. I think, number one, just to chisel away at their debt, the standard operating procedures is to have a little bit of inflation, right? I think the ideal thing, the Fed would never say this, but probably isn't the ideal thing to have a little bit higher than normal inflation and just reduce the burden of their massive government debt. It wouldn't be their best case scenario going forward.
Well, you see, I think central banks have zero control over inflation. They're like the remainder after you put all the factors in.
I see.
the bigger drive for inflation is really policy, both fiscal policy and institutional policy. So if you see from like this, you know, from the 70s, 80s, tariff rates were falling, globalization was increasing, and unions were being defanged, and we saw nationalization. These are all deflationary policies. And I see all of these policies now reversing and governments becoming more pro-labor. And so what I suspect is, well, actually, it's not suspect. What is happening and what I think will continue to happen is that growth will always be much better than expected constantly. Prices and inflation will be much stronger than expected. And central banks will have to raise interest rates more. I think they've been lucky in so far that the Chinese policy of crushing the property bubble has been globally deflationary. So it's offset a lot of the inflationary policies in the West. But that's not, you know, they're really a long way into that bubble bursting. And so I think the surprises all going forward are inflationary and very inflationary, in fact.
Do you have any longer term predictions about either the Japanese or the Chinese economy? Like in terms of the Japanese economy, when you look at their debt burden, which I guess is mostly held domestically, right? Can they just sustain that forever, or could they have a crisis?
Well, it's an interesting question because, you know, most of that debt now sits at the Bank of Japan. They certainly don't have the equity available to cover the losses on those bonds. You know, but they theoretically, you know, you could do what they normally do is say they hold them to maturity. So they get back par value and, you know, and they can just ignore that. What I think is, you know, way I sort of think of debt burdens, I think the best way to think about debt burden is like, you know, if you go back to the 70s, right, when we had inflation and high interest rates, there was no fiscal debt. It collapsed, right? Because actually in this sort of deflationary period, government debt burdens have risen massively. And I think the reason for this is that if you So I also used to do emerging markets. So, and emerging markets always used to have inflation. It's always there. And you know why they always had inflation? Because typically about 2 months before any election, they would raise public servant salaries 20 to 25%, right? Re-election. Now, what I find strange is if we want inflation in any country, why don't we raise teacher salaries by 20 to 25%? What is actually stopping us from doing that? Nothing except politics. You know, if you go out and raise public servant wages, you don't get elected, at least in the States. I think in the UK, it's probably different now. There's, I think, a real appetite for public sector wages to rise. What I'm trying to say is inflation is not, it's not an economic phenomenon. It's a political phenomenon. And it represents a different way of getting elected. And what I find really interesting and why I think inflation in the States is coming is that historically speaking, if you had 3% unemployment, stock market all-time high, property prices doing well, Biden should be cruising for re-election. And also Trump back in the day, back in 2020, should have been cruising for re-election. Yes. Same in the UK. We have the same dynamics. We don't, because I think this asset price policy, asset-led policy models don't actually win votes anymore. People are tired of the inequality.
Well, what do you think of this hypothesis that most of those assets are held by a couple percent of the U.S. population? I don't think most people, just if I go, I live in Michigan. If I go out and just talk to people and I ask, hey, do you think the economy is good? I think most Americans don't think that at all and haven't thought that for a long time. So those things could be somewhat decoupled because the people who are actually holding, you know, when you say, oh, stock market's doing great. Okay. But who owns the stock market? Do average people own the stock market? No. You know, average people, I think some economists would argue their real spending power hasn't increased in decades in the United States. And so I don't know if that's true. Okay. But some people claim that. And it does seem that way. It seems like now here, both parents have to work full-time jobs to make ends meet in most families. And You know, that certainly wasn't true when I was growing up. And so I think people don't feel times are that great.
I agree. I think, well, that's the thing is, like, I think post-World War II policy, this is something I wrote about, but like, if you look at, I use the UK because the UK is very simple. We only have like really House of Commons. We don't have all these different states and all stuff. But I think what happened in the post-World War II period was that avoid the Great Depression. So they had these policies of expanding state and expanding unionization. But what I think Labour governments found was that expanding unionization, expanding nationalization actually created more Labour voters. You know, if you're a union member or you work for a nationalized company, you're more likely to vote Labour. So there was this sort of, using the tech term, this, you know, windmill, flywheel of policies becoming more and more entrenched. So when Thatcher and Reagan broke that, because those policies started to fail, when they broke the political hold, you had the reverse thing happening where they tried to make as many people as possible as homeowners. They tried to privatize as many businesses to make unions as small as possible. And the more people owned homes, the more they were private sector worker, the more they were a shareholder. So the UK had big privatizations that were marketed to retail investors, created more naturally conservative voters. That made sense. So it's like a flywheel. And I think we're now at that transition point where the benefits flow to too few people. So the political machinations has changed. And that's where I think we are. That's why I'm very convinced that we are in a new inflationary world. And I think inflation rates will go much higher. Growth will be very good. I think it'll be very, very good. And unemployment will be low. The only problem is that leverage players, people who have a lot of leverage, will get into deep trouble, which I personally have no problem with. I hate private equity. These guys drive me nuts. I hate speculators who have done really well. And also you can see that policy so Biden's announced tax policies are like share buybacks, wealth tax to a degree. So the incentives to push up asset values to excessive levels is going to change as well. And so we're moving to a very different world. I can see it quite clearly. It's just taking its time. But if you look, once you understand or think from that perspective, it's happening everywhere. It's happening everywhere all the time. What's the maybe title? Anyway, but yeah, you know, so fascinating. The really weird thing is it's happening in China. The only country it's not happening in is Japan. But I wonder if that's because their property prices are so low in Japan, so that there's not that same pushback. But then I'll be honest with you, having lived in Japan and speak Japanese, I am sure there's some sort of negative political pushback to basically having loads of Korean and Chinese tourists. You know, I just feel like there'd be like older Japanese in particular going, didn't we used to be richer than these guys? You know, why are they visiting us? We should be going to them.
It's interesting that we've come back to Japan, because one of the things I do for fun is there are a ton of YouTube channels where people just go around Tokyo or Osaka and they just interview people on the street. And I love to watch those just to hear what the average Japanese is thinking. And if you go on YouTube and search around for these, you might find these interesting too. Yeah, I don't know what the feelings are, but it seems like younger Japanese are very, what's the right word? Herbivore. Like, they're kind of accepting of everything. Like, even if you ask some questions about, like, would it be okay if tons of people from Vietnam immigrate to, or India immigrate to Japan? Most of them are just like, yeah, that's cool. It's usually only the older Japanese that remember that they used to be rich and maybe are a little bit outraged that the Korean tourists and Chinese tourists are all over the country. So I don't know. It's a fascinating question. I don't know the answer, but I think there is some data. Now, the problem with these YouTube channels is that it's somewhat selected. They show the interviews that are the most entertaining to get clicks, to get views. But still, it gives you some insight to the way ordinary Japanese are thinking about these things.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. It could be a new world. I don't know. I need to get out of Europe and spend more time in Asia.
Yeah, you should travel.
I wish I could.
Yeah.
I wish I could, but not busy.
I see. Well, hey, Russell, you've given me a ton of things to think about, and probably the audience too. I really enjoyed this conversation. Let me end with one thing that I wanted to ask you. Is it, if you just, whether you look at PPP or just, nominal exchange weighted incomes, it seems like nowadays Americans are kind of like 1.5 or maybe even 2 times richer than or earn more than not just people in Japan, but also like UK and even in Europe. And does that seem like a distortion to you, or is that like the way things should be given the performance of the relative performance of the economies?
Back when I first started working, .com bubble, salaries in the States were probably like 3-4 times salaries in Australia at that time.
Oh, wow.
So Australia was really tied into the Asian cycle. So it was a very depressed Asian cycle, and then you go to other parts of Asia and people were very poor. So mainland China was super poor back then. From that perspective, not so much, but I always find it's very tricky to compare apples for apples, because there are a lot of things in the States that you have to pay for that, other countries don't charge you for, like healthcare, or health insurance. And it's also hard to compare because tipping is quite high in the States. You have to pay like 25% for everything. And so you get like I say, it's hard to compare apples for apples. And there's virtually no public transport. It's I find it very difficult to compare. I was reading The Economist, who was talking about Vodafone, which is the big UK mobile phone operator here, and it was saying it can only charge 1/3 of what the big US ones, so the ARPU in US ones are 3 times higher. Yeah. And I was thinking to myself, well, I pay for mobile phones. Yeah, I mean, like 10, 15 quid a month for unlimited data, whatever. That seems to me about the right price for a very old technology that's fully depreciated. And this is a thing in the States. They allowed you to get to 3 operators, T-Mobile, bar Sprint or something like that.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why you only have 3 operators. It's the same with the airlines when, JetBlue got bought one of the other operators, and then suddenly the market fell to 3 and prices went through the roof, right? Now, is that the sign of does that make you wealthier? Does that make a better economy? I personally don't think so, but the way GDP is measured, it is. And, there's a lot of, I tried to do the numbers once, but so in the UK, drugs are priced very affordably, right? Whereas typically in the States, drug prices are much, much higher. And with no, obviously, health benefits, the life expectancy in the States is now lower than the life expectancy in the UK for men anyway. So you've got a whole sector that probably generates lots of profits, has much higher revenue, but has no obvious benefit to GDP, life expectancy, or anything else. So how do you compare that, if that makes sense?
I just had the same conversation regarding China versus the U.S. because I think healthcare now is something like 17% of U.S. GDP. It's some very high chunk of our GDP, and doesn't seem to be, except maybe for edge cases where you really need special care and we're pioneering new drugs and research and stuff like that. Yeah, we are the world leader. But in terms of the care that the average person gets for most of their life, doesn't seem to be that much better. And our life expectancy, I think, now is equal to or maybe slightly less than China. So, it seems like we're spending a lot of money for something, but I'm not sure exactly if we're getting value for money.
No, but it creates a lot of wealth. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's the US free market capitalist way of doing things is that, you know, allow people to generate as much wealth. But I think that creates a bigger GDP. You know, like I said, what the biggest surprise for me is that why can't the US run a balanced budget given all these benefits? And I have very, you know, I wonder if it's a philosophical thing where the states, because there are a lot of people in the Republican Party and in the tech sector who basically believe that, you know, federal government shouldn't exist. So they're trying to starve it of revenues. The irony of that, though, is as soon as there's a recession, they're begging the federal government to spend stimulus checks and offering guarantees. But, you know, from a profit maximizing point of view, I understand where they're coming from. But, you know, typically you don't see any, I wouldn't see any change in the states until you see some sort of debt crisis. I don't see a debt crisis until the Japanese get rid of negative interest rates. Because with negative interest rates, anything looks good. So it's when Japan changes its policy, so then we can start seeing what happens with the states.
Yeah. In my lifetime, we went from Bill Clinton talking about the bond vigilantes to slowly the government realizes it can just spend as much as it wants and there doesn't seem to be any negative impact, right? So until a corrective is issued, and that maybe in terms of a shock, we're probably just going to keep doing it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the that is the capitalist way, is like it exploits any underutilized asset until there's some sort of reaction. And I think the bond market is that underutilized asset. And they're going to keep exploiting it until something gives. Politically, either outside, so there'd be foreigners not willing to buy dollars anymore, or internally where labor starts demanding a much larger share, which creates an inflation. So there is a theory of interest rate, a political interest rate theory, which I personally subscribe to, is that interest rates rising is just a way of making sure that labor stays under control. So you only interest rates are only rise when you need to get wages down again. And that's why they were so high in the 70s, because unions were so strong.
Yeah, I see. Well, Russell, thanks a lot for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation. When I prepare the show notes, I'll put a link to your writings. And is there anything else that are you also on Twitter? Should we link to your Twitter account? No.
No, I don't use Twitter much anymore. I just use my Substack. I have far more subscribers on my Substack these days anyway. So I find Substack works quite well for me. I like it. So that's it. Just the Substack's fine, which is www.russell-clark.com.
Great. All right. Well, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. I really enjoyed it.